It is a really huge honor to interview Father Sirico today. Father Robert Sirico is President Emeritus of the Acton Institute, which he co-founded with Chris Morin 35 years ago. And the mission of the Acton Institute is to promote a free and virtuous society characterized by individual liberty and sustained by religious principles. Father Sirico is a well-known lecturer and author. His latest book is The Economics of the Parables, which he published in 2022. And in 2023, you granted us an interview centered on the content of that book. So we've already discussed that book. Great. But a year before that, Father Sirico published A Legacy of Liberty, The Founder's Vision for the Acton Institute, which addresses some of the topics that I would like to focus on today, because sure. Acton is celebrating its 35th anniversary, and Instituto Fe y Libertad, which was directly inspired by Acton, is now 10 years old. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Carol. It's so good to be here in this beautiful environment.
Thank you. Well, we met many years ago, even before you joined forces with Chris Morin to establish the Acton Institute. Can you tell us how you came up with the idea of setting up the Institute?
Well, it came out of my own conversion, as it were. I was away from the church in my younger years, and in my mid-20s was involved with the political agenda of the left in California, where I was living at the time. And at that time, I met someone who introduced me to the liberal tradition through books. And I began reading these books, all of which the authors that I read initially were all secular authors. But it precipitated a change in my social and economic and political thinking that also invited me to consider more deeply the human person, because if we're talking about politics or economy, we're talking about the human person at the center of it. And it was that recalled for me my early training as a Catholic, even my catechetical training, and prompted me to look into that, and I returned to the church. Then later, when I recovered my vocation to pursue the priesthood, I went into seminary and found all of the things I had left on the streets of California in the seminary in those days, this is the 1980s, in the form of liberation theology. And so I began to make a study of liberation theology on a more formal basis, both theologically and what I knew of economics. And that prompted in me the need to form some kind of institution. And I probably mention it in every interview I give in Guatemala, but that idea took place in Antigua, Guatemala, in 1990 when I was attending the Mount Pelerin Society meeting.
That's right. We're kind of proud of that link.
I'm deeply grateful for it.
The Acton Institute and Guatemala. Why a think tank? What is the place of research centers in academic circles and in society at large?
Well, there's a whole way of getting ideas into the mainstream, and they have to start with concrete and serious academic research, which is not as attractive to the broad population, but is necessary for a firm foundation for whatever it is you're going to build on top of it. And this is, by the way, Hayek's model of social change. And so when you do that, then you begin the process of popularizing that at a level that deals with what Hayek calls in his essay, The Intellectuals and Socialism, the second-hand dealers in ideas. So these are editorialists, and he mentions religious leaders, the clergy, as the second-hand dealers in ideas, that they take the scholarship and then apply it to a more broad audience. And then the third level is the real popularization, which we've done at ACT in the last 25 years or so, in films. And now beginning, more stories, parables, if you will. Mm-hmm. We're even having discussions about how to translate this to the level of children.
That is great. What is the process by which you came up with the Acton Institute's principles, and how do you set up the philosophical and economical framework that you were going to be developing?
In our case, I suppose it started with early on when Chris Mauron, who was working at that time in Hawaii, he had been hoping to go and work in China because he had done international studies at Johns Hopkins University, and I persuaded him to come. He ended up having to be in Hawaii because of Tiananmen Square, and they closed down the project that he was going to work on. But he always had a love of Asia, and he came to Grand Rapids, and we were talking about the founding of an institute in order to more efficiently disseminate these kinds of ideas, to teach teachers, uh-huh. to help form those who would be involved in the formation of the moral consensus. And I went on a retreat, a private retreat, in which I wrote two documents. One was called the Entrepreneurial Vocation, applying the ideas of theology to the reality of business. And then the second was called Toward a Free and Virtuous Society, which is written more toward academic and seminary mm-hmm. Kinds of people who think theologically and philosophically. And those became kind of the founding documents. And from there, as we added scholars to the Institute, these ideas were refined and then put into a set of principles that are now available on the Acton Institute website.
They're very clearly drafted.
Yes,
and
yeah.
very helpful.
That was a process. That was mm-hmm. the end of a process. I wish I was that clear in the first instance.
You have undergone a leadership transition since yes. you are now President Emeritus,
yes.
and Chris Mauron is now leading the...
I never use the word retire.
Okay.
Because I'm still very...
Well,
busy.
You're not. You're very active yes, still. Yes. But I think that one of the inevitable questions that comes up when you're talking about transitioning
yeah.
is how do you ensure that the mission remains intact and that the next generations develop the Acton Institute in the way that you envisioned it?
Yes. This is always a risk in the transition of anything. In fact... if I may revert to my area of theology, mm-hmm. Cardinal Newman, newly named a doctor of the church, wrote a magnificent thesis on exactly this topic, which he called On the Development of Christian Doctrine. What he does there is face the challenge of the church receiving the deposit of faith, which we call in mm-hmm. theology, the deposit of faith, the core belief in salvation through Christ and his resurrection, and how that would be transmitted from generation to generation. And he goes through a whole historical process of showing the refinement of that development. And in that essay, he says, an authentic development, not an aberration, but an authentic development is that which takes the implicit and makes it explicit. So the developments, the changes, have to have continuity and a fidelity to the initial insight. Very often, the heresies were starting with the deposit of faith and then becoming aberrant, mm-hmm. really ending up with the opposite. There's a challenge in the church today. I think likewise in any intellectual movements and institutions, you have this challenge to take the original insight and then maintain its integrity. In the case of the Acton Institute, we were fortunate, and really it was providence, that Chris Mauron, as the co-founder of the Institute, was 16 years my junior.
Mm-hmm.
I introduced him initially, when he was a freshman at Johns Hopkins University, to the literature of liberty. He went to seminars and really took to it. And over the years of our early friendship, it was an enthusiasm for these kinds of ideas. We even organized a little conference, which we called the Proto-Acton Institute Conference at Johns Hopkins University, that was funded mutually by the Democratic Students Association and the Republican Students Association. That was Chris's genius, his organizational genius, which he's maintained all of these years. And what happened was, in our founding the Acton Institute, we were always of one mind about what we were doing. We would have disagreements about the timing of things or the way to express something, but the core commitment to human freedom, understanding that liberty is the political end of man, but not the total end of man. That man has a destiny beyond liberty. And I think what gives us a longer transition is the fact that when I retired after 30 years, I guess, well, a little more than 30 years, Chris took over, and it was virtually seamless. Mm-hmm. Now he's, now that he's come into his own, you know, after a few years of being the president of the Institute, is taking the Institute in other directions. I won't say other directions, but other developments, other unfolding of the mission in ways that I am excited to see and want to help him do. So if you were to ask me the secret to that, I mean, not everybody can found an institute and have a partner in doing it who's 16 years their junior and stuff. But I think one of the things that have to be resisted, well, two things. One is a kind of egocentrism, that the organization can be augmented and helped by the charisma of the founder, but it cannot be absorbed into the personality of the founder. So it takes a responsibility on the part of a founder to relinquish decision-making and to hear the opinions of other people while still maintaining a fidelity to the core insight. And then the second thing is not to think that your mission is the whole of the mission of the whole world. You know, the Acton Institute doesn't think that we are the only organization that exists and we're the most important organization. I mean, if you look honestly, what we're doing is a very important part. And I think society would be a lot worse without these kinds of ideas. But I don't think it's the whole mission of where humanity and the world has to go in 2,000 years.
So in other words, humility.
I guess so, yes, which means, humility means a love of the truth above everything else. Mm-hmm. And we love the truth. And then, of course, and I'll let you ask more questions about this if you want. I don't want to anticipate your questions. Then, of course, it's key to hire to the mission. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who come, Acton has a subtle mission, this connection between liberty and morality. And a lot of people come to it and envision what they think the Acton Institute is. And when we hire, we have to, and we've gotten better at it over the years, but we have to kind of drill down to see if they really understand what we're doing, or if they're coming thinking, well, I need a job and I want it to be this, in this basic realm. Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say we can't have diversity and stuff, but it has to be some kind of respect for the core of the mission. And we've made mistakes in that field over the years. You know, people who didn't mesh, who of their own accord or with our encouragement left.
Left. Yes. Well, it also grew a lot at the Acton Institute, so you have a large staff, and yes.
Yeah.
So I can see how that would happen. And
the financial stability is a part of it too. And I have to say that Chris was the business, the internal genius of getting things done, of having, I've always been the big picture guy and getting out there on a mission and having a certain tolerance of risk that Chris didn't have. He always would hold back, and that tension between the two of us grew a very solid organization, both in terms of mission, but also in terms of the management and the stewardship of the resources, so that we never in 35 years ran a deficit. We've always met our budget. There were moments where we had to pull back, especially I remember in 2008 during the financial crisis. I remember sitting at a meeting of the leadership of the Institute, and I think it was Chris. He said that there's something in the wind that we have to take account of. And we pulled back our programs by, if I remember correctly, about 25%. Not giving raises, not giving bonuses. And I believe it was at that time that both Chris and I know we did this during COVID as well, we did not take a salary. And what that meant was we went through and never hit a deficit. In COVID, we kind of, one year to the other, we were even.
Mm-hmm.
And then
you could beyond. Continue to grow.
And we've never had an endowment. That's the other thing. We've had very generous donors, but no one that has ever come and said, I'll pay for the whole thing. We're still looking for that person.
What are some of the misconceptions about economics and entrepreneurship that you set out to correct?
I would say that one of the things we wanted to correct was the idea that entrepreneurship is essentially about selfishness, about material gain. It certainly has to involve profit, because why would you set out to do something that wouldn't be profitable? I mean, this is one of the great economic fallacies that people have bought into, is that that profits are somehow irrelevant or even sinful in the moral context. But of course, that's nonsense, because it's easy not to make a profit. Just don't do anything and you have poverty. That's what not making a profit is. But also not to understand that the essential goal of a business, or the goal of the entrepreneur, better, is just profit making. There's a certain dimension that it is human fulfillment and human flourishing. And as I've talked with many business leaders, not all, but many business leaders, they really see it that way intuitively, that they're doing something that gives them life and that invigorates them and causes them to create more and to risk more, because they have an idea and they see it as an extension of themselves. And only a few business people that I've met ever have as their goal money.
Mm-hmm.
Money is the consequence of an insight, of a tendency, of a desire to create. And then they can enjoy the toys, and a lot of them don't even do that. You know, you take a person like Elon Musk, I think he's the richest man in the world. He lives in a kind of monkish sort of way, as far as I understand. I mean, I don't know Mr. Musk, but as I understand, he's really detached from
material things.
The material things. He's just interested in much
in
bigger
creating
things.
Creating.
Yes.
And being co-creator.
Yes, and this is a whole biblical thing for us.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. And how about virtue, you know, teaching businessmen that what they do is linked to virtue, and that you can have a virtuous life and be productive as well.
Yeah, and that's, on the one hand, I think in many cases, that's something that many business leaders intuitively know. You know, we've described the Acton Institute as a project of translation, of taking the vocabulary and the categories of theology and morality and retranslating them into the vocabulary of business. And vice versa, to help religious leaders come to respect the technique mm-hmm. of business. You know, that it's not enough to just have a desire to be good. How are you going to do that? Mm-hmm. Piety is never a substitute for technique. I'm fond of quoting Etienne Gilson in saying that. Piety is never a substitute for technique. Technique is the way in which we make piety real in the world. And so the reverse of that is true, too, that technique is never sufficient, and that what we need to do is tease out or help entrepreneurs meditate deeply enough on what it is that they are doing that makes them successful. And what you find underneath this very often is are seeds of virtue. I'm thinking of being other regarding. You know, in Christian vocabulary, we'd say being other regarding is to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, or to express it in terms of solidarity, being attentive and being connected to other people, especially in the vulnerability. In market terms, being other regarding means to have your eye on what a consumer needs, mm-hmm. the needs of people, and how can I produce something that will serve their needs, so that you come to see your enterprise as service and profit as the consequence and evidence that you have served mm-hmm. people in the way you set out to do it. So it's a matter of defining things from within what people already know and not just introducing an alien thing on top of it. Now, that's certainly not the case among all business people, because there are some business people who just want the toys. I, in the end, don't think that their enterprises are as stable, have as much quality in the end in terms of what you offer to other people, because then you can just offer junk if people will buy it. Mm-hmm. And I also don't think that the entrepreneur, him or herself, is as content with mm-hmm. their life.
That is a very profound insight. I think it's very and very true. What are the misconceptions of the current era? You know, what should we be? What ideas should we be looking out for and trying to rebuttal?
Well, I think, and this is a recurrent theme. It's not just today. I mean, you see these things in history. There's nothing new, mm-hmm. you know. But this moment in history, one of the things I see especially impacting, what should we call it, the movement of liberty, you know, the kind of liberal idea mm-hmm. in the European sense of the word liberal, that is focusing on human freedom, is the thing that Adam Smith identifies in The Wealth of Nations, the tendency of business people to want to just advance themselves without regard to other people. The form that takes today, even in some conservative circles that would have been considered free market, would have been considered oriented toward capitalism, is crony capitalism. It's where the business person has this desire to produce, but doesn't have the moral formation that gives them the integrity to collaborate through competition, and instead to preempt the competitive dimension of this, which is what refines enterprise and serves people better, mm-hmm. but to preempt that so as to take an unfair advantage, whether that's in the form of government subsidies or regulations that impede our competitors. We defeat ourselves. I think business people defeat themselves when they impede their competitors because they're insecure that their own work doesn't have as compelling a case for it as mm-hmm. as their competitors. You see, competition mm-hmm. is a form of cooperation, and it ends in benefiting the mass of people who we call the consumers.
It's a sort of shortcut that in the long run, it impoverishes all of society.
It does. It cheats. It's cutting into the line.
So what's next for Acton Institute?
Well, I have great confidence in what Chris is doing. And by the way, I should say that I think if there's going to be a challenge in the typical way that successions meet challenges, I can name you a whole list of institutions, whether religious or economic or political or conservative or progressive, that hit crisis points in their succession, precisely for some of the things we've talked about, a mission drift and a leadership difference and all of these kinds of things. If the Acton Institute is going to confront that, it's going to confront it in Chris's transition, because we had this trusting relationship and this friendship over the years. So, but what I've seen Chris take on in the last 2 years is really impressive and humbles me to think, gee, I wish I had that idea. You know, that's a great idea. And I more than one time in the last 2 years wish that I had, wish that I was a little younger. I wish I had the perspective then when we met 35 years ago, or more than 35 years ago, yeah. I think, you know, as I'm thinking about it, I may know you longer than I know Chris. I'm trying to think if I knew Chris when I met you. It was very close.
Very close,
but,
probably.
But I think that the project right now that we're working on, that Chris has asked me to be involved in, is the expansion of our Rome office. We've had an office in Rome for over 20 years with really good relations with curial officials and the Roman seminaries and everything. But we see a new opportunity now with a new pontificate and a new openness on the part of the curia to work with people that maybe they haven't experienced working with. Because the curia is new too. You know, I mean, the curia is constantly changing. And that is to build an entity in Rome that would be larger than what we have now, would have a welcoming space, and that would be a convening space for ideas, the diplomatic corps, the academic communities, the ambassadorships that exist in Rome, the pilgrims that come through Rome on a regular basis, and then finding other aligned organizations who do not have a permanent presence in Rome, but want to have a seminar or a conference from time to time in Rome, but have a real challenge of kind of how do you do that when you don't speak the language, or you don't know the culture, or you don't have to make the connections. We've done that. We've been there. We know the names, the places to go, and the restaurants to eat in, and all of that. And so that this convening place would also be a place for aligned organizations to come and have an opportunity to present their ideas to this unique community in Rome.
That sounds very, very interesting.
Think of it as an embassy for freedom.
For freedom. That's wonderful. Well, thank you very much for this interview. I am also going to take advantage of this opportunity to thank you for the support you've given Instituto Fe y Libertas from the very beginning.
Yes.
You gave us permission to translate and use all of the material that Acton Institute has produced. And we have really benefited from using Poverty Cure in some of your media productions, The Good Society. And so we are indebted to the Acton Institute. And so thank you very, very much. And thank you for being here.
I value our friendship and our collaboration over all the years. Thank you very much.